And you have this big increase in market integration. So you can actually, I show plots in the book of the increase in the number of these fairs. So this is like, you know, let's all come to town on Monday and we'll all trade our wares and we'll, you know, buy the stuff that we can't make and we'll sell our wheat or whatever we're growing. And you can still find this in parts of the world today. So I draw in from ethnography from around the world where I can show the psychological effects of markets. But there's reason to think that markets make people more pro-social towards strangers. So as these markets expand, people are becoming more willing to interact and cooperate with strangers, and they have small families, so they don't have this big set of clan loyalties and other people they can trade with. So there's kind of both a push and a pull for interacting and making deals and starting business enterprises with strangers. And this so growing market integration changes the nature of the West. It leads to economic prosperity for well understood economic reasons, but then it also is changing people's psychology.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Mathilde Fasting, and today I'm joined by Professor of Human Evolutionary Biology, Joseph Henrich at Harvard. And he has also taught subjects like psychology and economics. We are going to discuss his latest book, The Weirdest People in the World, How the West Became Psychologically Peculiar and Prosperous. Welcome, Joe.
Ah, well, it's good to be with you, Mathilde.
You are online from Massachusetts and I'm here in Oslo, and we are all surrounded by COVID and things, but we are able to talk.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's good with technology somehow. A good starting point for your for this conversation might be the question that you pose or guidelines that you pose on your webpage. And you say, how can we explain the peculiar psychology and behavioral patterns observed in societies that are Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic? And you have the short word for that, and that is...
Oh, yes, our acronym, WEIRD.
Yeah. So how would you describe a weird person?
Well, I mean, we developed the acronym in order to really highlight the fact that so many of the participants in typical psychological experiments are psychologically unusual. And some of the patterns that I highlight in the book that, you know, vary continuously across societies, of course. There's, you don't want to have a dichotomy in your mind. But people tend to be, weird people tend to be more individualistic, focused on themselves. They have a kind of atomistic self-concept. They're much more affected by shame in contrast to guilt. They tend to be overconfident. They tend to be analytic versus holistic thinkers. So they focus on objects or individuals and their properties rather than looking at the relationships between those, kind of a bias in how they think. There's a high degree of impersonal pro-sociality, which would be things like trust and fairness towards strangers. And this contrasts with interpersonal pro-sociality, which is the loyalty you have to close friends or extended members of your kin network, things like that. So those are some of the key characteristics. I also highlighted patience and some unusual patterns of personality configurations.
Yeah, and you also have this experiment of telling people what they think about when you say, I am. And I've tried to think about that and I thought, okay, I'm Mathilde. And that's probably typically weird.
Yeah, and you even see that in how people introduce themselves. So in Western societies, you'll often say your name when you first interact with someone. You know, in the past, it would be like a Mr. or Mrs. kind of thing. And, you know, now, at least in the US, it's more first names, but it's still about personal identity. Whereas in lots of places, your name doesn't even come up until well into the conversation. It's more about where you're from and who your group is.
And also maybe your profession. That will come. Yeah. So what you are doing in life and who you are is really important.
Right.
Yeah. And when you go to other places in the world, how would it be there?
Well, it's much more like the group you're coming from, the place you're coming from, less about your occupation. So that just comes later. So there's a lot about identifying you as a kind of member to figure out information about you, where we're like more about being individuals.
Well, let's start with something that I found not very interesting about your book is that actually you are saying that this has become something that's come into our brains, if I could say it very, very easily. It's something that we are actually, our brain has changed because of this. So how our brain functions is different from other people in other places of the world. Can you explain a little bit about how you found out those things? Because that's intriguing. Yeah.
So, I mean, I emphasize that, and I emphasized it even more in a previous book called The Secret of Our Success. But there's a tendency, and I think this is probably an innate tendency, to think of the world dualistically. So people think of biology and kind of physiology on one side, and separately they think about mind and our wants and desires and things like that as somehow separate from our biology. So people often distinguish biology and culture. And the point that I really opened the book with is that as we're learning something, we're actually shaping our brains. So you can have two twins who are genetically identical. And if they're raised in different cultures and different societies, then they end up with different brains, even though they're genetically identical. And that's because our brains are so plastic and so responsive to our experiences. And culture in many ways is kind of a training regime. And you grow up in a particular training regime and you acquire ways of processing information that help you navigate that social world. And the best studied example we have, which I open the book with, is reading. So when you learn to read as a child, you develop specialized circuitry in your left ventral hemisphere, your corpus callosa, which is the information highway that connects your left and right hemispheres, thickens, and so you have more information transfer. And even when you're not doing reading, when you're just hearing spoken speech, you get activation on both sides of your brain in the way that non-literate folks don't. So it's just a simple cultural practice that we can trace back to a certain point in at least widespread literacy. It didn't become common until, you know, after the 16th century with the Protestant Reformation. And then it spreads rapidly, and a number of European countries have high rates of literacy, and that's still spreading across the world at this point. But that's it. That's leading to a change in our brain, which is relatively recent. And I think there are lots of things like that. And there's a field called cultural neuroscience, which is gradually documenting all these effects.
So this is, would you say that some of this research that you are doing and colleagues of yours are doing here are, it seems that you are developing into areas that we usually didn't think of before. And you also said something about the duality of physicality on one side and our minds on the other side. That's also typically Western, isn't it?
Well, you actually find dualism. So, you know, people often try to blame dualism on Descartes, but my colleagues and I have done experiments on, populations in the South Pacific, for example. And we find that even young kids will tend to think dualistically. They separate the minds and the bodies. And cognitive scientists have argued that this inclination towards dualism has to do with the fact that as humans, we developed a really powerful system for thinking about minds as independent of our bodies. But we have an older system that all animals have, you know, lots of animals anyway, for tracking bodies of other animals. And so the fact that we think about those with separate systems means they're easily partitioned. So if you watch a movie and you see a character do a mind-body switch, which Freaky Friday or there's many different variants of this, you know, you can go along with it. That doesn't seem crazy or outrageous. But if you actually understand the neuroscience, that should be like crazy and outrageous. It should be not like not existing on Tuesdays and Thursdays, which we don't find very plausible. You've got to be somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. So that then pervades our thinking and affects this tendency to partition minds and bodies.
So in September, I talked to Tom Holland about his book, Dominion. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but he traces Christian influence on our minds. And you said, am I thinking about mind and soul, about something separate, absolutely has to do with religion. And he gets really into how this religion, Christendom, influenced our minds, morals, social norms and everything. So how much do you think that religion has influenced us according to you and your research? If we go back in time, he goes back until to the birth of Christ.
Right. Well, the case that I make in The Weirdest People in the World is that the biggest channel for the influence of what became the Roman Catholic Church was their program, their marriage and family program, where they systematically broke down the intensive kinship networks that you found in European populations that included polygyny and often cousin marriage, and lots of kinds of things that you find in kinship systems throughout the world, and broke it down to monogamous nuclear families. And that forced people to develop new kinds of institutions. Eventually, these became guilds and universities and charter towns. And modern firms are a version of this. And so it put Western Europe on a trajectory, a social trajectory, which was distinct from ones that had came previously, because there's so kinship was so interwoven in the society, and the church kind of unwittingly had kind of eliminated those, and it sent us down this kind of, you know, with contracts and lots of market commerce among strangers and things like that. So that was an inadvertent effect of the church. Now, some of the things like concepts of sin and the similarity between that and guilt, I think that was there, but it became even more accentuated in this tradition because of the role of individualism and guilt in these non-kin-based societies.
Yeah, because you have an appendix in your book about family patterns, and you can maybe explain even more in detail the psychology, sociology, and the important milestones in this project, your process. You mentioned a few of them now. I've noted down Gregory Pope and Who to Marry, as you said, the Cluny Abbey, guilds, and so forth. So take us very quickly through that.
Well, beginning in late antiquity, some Christian emperors begin outlawing things like cousin marriage, but they have trouble because the people push back and then they have to kind of backtrack on those. But then by the time you're moving into the fifth and sixth centuries, you're beginning to get the churches kind of spreading out into different parts of Europe. And it's writing down the law codes of the different, you know, quote, barbarian tribes that they're encountering there. And, you know, they're getting them to adopt practices like banning cousin marriage and ending polygamy. They're pushing the concept of illegitimate children so that the children of secondary wives or these kind of lower tier wives that elite men had can't inherit the estate and those kinds of things. So they're doing lots of little things to kind of prevent all that. But the consequence of that is to lead to the breakdown of these families. So simply like preventing polygyny has a big effect. And then cousin marriage actually gets tabooed and banned, thought to be incest, all the way out to six cousins by around the year 1000. And now the church has to back off that at 1215, the Fourth Lateran Council, but it still maintains a taboo on first and second cousins.
And they did that because they had the church structure it was important to them because of power structures to do those things.
Yeah, I mean, there's a debate amongst historians as to why they were doing that. There's definitely a tone at which at one level of explanation, people thought that it was incestuous to marry your cousins, and that doing so made God angry. So there are justifications or explanations for plagues, for example, that are hitting because, you know, too many people are engaging in incest. And what they meant by that is people were marrying their cousins. And there's lots of condemnations of that kind of thing. Now, the argument has been made that the church was able to do this. It also modified the rules of testament so that when people died, they could give wealth to the church. And so these rules kind of ended a lot of lineages because you couldn't adopt people also into your lineage. And it prevented collateral relatives from inheriting. So this allowed people to testament lands to the church, and the church was able to get very wealthy on this. So bishoprics that adopted and enforced these practices may have prospered financially due to these practices. But the degree to which that was conscious or an unconscious thing that evolved, you know, either way it spread, and, you know, we have a debate about what the details were.
Yeah, I guess the thing was not to change family patterns as some strategy for today. It was something that happened back then, but really early in history. It's almost 2,000 years ago. It's not exactly, but 1,500 years at least. So I've read a recent book, another one by a man called Larry Siedentop, Inventing the Individual. And he says his next part of the title is The Origins of Western Liberalism. And he says that same thing that you say, that in the family, family was a pillar in ancient societies, not the individual, as you just explained, but that changed with St. Paul and Christendom. And he goes on to enlighten many important changes throughout the Middle Ages, actually making this period really important when it comes to laws, institutions, and norms. And I guess what you say, you agree. Do you know his book?
Yeah, I know his book. I think I cited it in The Weirdest People in the World. One big impact or import of all that is into the construction of Western law. So Western law is really spread out all over the world. So, you know, Japan started adopting Western civil codes in the 1880s. China adopts it around 1950 or so with the communist government came into power. But these are laws that really focus on the individual and assign rights and rules and properties to the individual. So it's very much analytical thinking and it's individual centered. Whereas in the Roman world, the head of house was the only person with kind of legal stature. The other members of the house were subservient to him in terms of their legal stature. And that's common across lots of societies. But one of the arguments I make is that the change in psychology meant when people began to think about, you know, how should we make laws for our new charter town? They thought of the individual as the locus, and they began to assign rights and properties and privileges and responsibilities to the individual independent of the family. And I even point to a few places where you can see debates. So at one place, a small town in Germany, the town wanted to like relieve fathers of having to take responsibility and possibly be punished for the crimes of their sons, which is standard. I mean, you find it in China, in 19th century China. So this was just basically saying if six worthy men can identify that the father wasn't involved, then he's off the hook, right? So you can see the process gradually isolating the individual independent from all the networks that interconnected people.
And according to you, how different was this in the West if we are now talking about the 15th, let's say we are in the 15th century somewhere, and compared to, for instance, China or other with the Muslim world?
Yeah, I mean, the case that I make in the book, and there's lots of scholarship behind this, is that there was much more of a kind of identity and group-based. So oftentimes different cultural groups would have different laws. You can see this in perhaps even in India in the 20th century, where Muslims could marry additional wives, but Hindus couldn't. There's a Hindu Marriage Act of 1955. And in China, I was mentioning about the fathers. Fathers were responsible for the crimes of their son until Western law was imported. And there were very different punishments depending on who you harmed. So if you punched your father, that's a very bad thing to do. But if you punched your son, he's kind of fair game.
So. Seems bad anyhow to punch people. But the importance of the individual and individualism, of course, is the clue to this, and also to the psychology here. And today, what are the largest differences between a Western definition of individual and individualism and other parts of the world? And I have a story that is also Sally saying something about how people think about individualism and how they think about when it came about. And that's Francis Fukuyama, who tells his students to just tell him when they think that individualism came about. And they come up with a lot of answers, and all of them are really recent. And then he says, he goes back to your example and goes back to late antiquity, and they all say, oh, is this really true? And usually the ones that are really not getting the concept right, they are from other parts of the world. He mentioned India, he mentioned China, he mentioned, well, other places, not the United States, even though they also thought it was more recent than antiquity.
Yeah, well, I think people have an intuition to think it was more recent because the rapid growth and economic prosperity. So since the Industrial Revolution, you might think that, well, people got wealthy and then they got independent or something like that. Or you might think Protestantism, like, so take a Max Weber point of view. Maybe it was the kind of very individualistic nature of Protestantism that drove this. Now, in the book, I argue that Protestantism plays a role and it's part of the story. But first, we have to figure out how you get to such an individualizing faith as Protestantism. So that can't come out of the blue, right? There's got to be some kind of long-term historical process. And so, you know, I make the case that it really begins with the church's altering of things. And the church is going strong on this tearing down of the families in the Carolingian Empire. So think 800 CE. And you begin to get early indications of lots of nuclear families in 900 and certainly then into the High Middle Ages. There's a fun book called The Origins of Individualism by McFarlane. Mm-hmm. And he tries to document individualism, and he gets back to, you know, 1200 or so. And it looks like people are quite individualistic in England in 1200. So, I mean, it's clearly older than the big growth it precedes the growth in economic prosperity.
So, but why didn't this happen in other places of the world?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And in the book, I mostly rely on the fact that, you know, different religions do different things. And in fact, there was nothing super special about Christianity per se. It was the branch of Christianity that led to the Roman Catholic Church and modern Protestantism. But if you zip back to 100 CE or 200 CE, that branch of Christianity wasn't super special. You might have thought the branches of the Syrian church or the, you know, the the Eastern Church that remained part of the Roman Empire until the fall of the Byzantine Empire in 1453 would have been the dominant strains. But 90% of contemporary Christians are descended from the Roman Catholic strain. So it was that one branch that happened to develop these strong norms and taboos that broke everyone down into monogamous nuclear families and led to the success of those societies and carried the religion along with it. And if you think about religions as, you know, kind of coming up with ideas about marriage and family program for idiosyncratic reasons, like not understanding the long-term consequences, different religions were doing different things. So Zoroastrianism was emphasizing cousin marriage and even some brother-sister marriage among elites pop up in Zoroastrianism. And then in Islam, you get this a constraint on polygyny down to four wives, no more than four equal wives. And you get a certain inheritance law that encourages parallel cousin marriage. So you marry your father's brother's son, if you're a female. So that's just some examples of ways they shape the family that then have potentially long-term consequences.
And what about the Orthodox part of Christianity? You say the church is actually split now, if you're thinking about. Do you see any difference in psychology and in thinking when you are looking at those parts of the world?
Yeah, so our data is not as great as it could be, but we do have cross-national data which allows us to look at that. And whenever we look at it, pretty consistently, the Eastern Church countries always have a kind of weak effect. So we see an effect of duration under that church, but not as strong as for the Western Church. And this kind of fits, I think, with the history. I mean, historians may want to debate this, but it looks like they had a kind of soft or weak marriage and family program. So they adopted some of the rules about cousin marriage, but they never got enthusiastic about it. They banned polygyny, but they were less enthusiastic about enforcement and took longer to kind of bring the more distant lands to heal, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so we can go into how important this psychological, we can say, it's also cultural, sociology, and lots of things, but let's call it psychological development for the general historical development of the West. Like for sociology, we had touched upon, but now let's talk about economically and politically.
Yeah, so I mean, the case that I make in the book is that these psychological changes, they legally started focusing people on the individual, but they also had to make new institutions, and the families were relatively weak. I mean, sometimes the families asserted themselves, and you see periods where powerful families will dominate. But because of the rules, those families often ended or eventually didn't have an heir or otherwise got defeated by another non-family-based institution. And so they're developing new institutions in these charter towns and small communities that are voluntary, that people are moving into, that are getting started. And the charter towns have a charter constitution, which often gives some kind of rights to citizens. So the beginnings of notions of citizens' rights are developing. And then, you know, initially the voting is representative, but it's representative of different voluntary organizations. So the monastery has a representative and the bakers have a representative. And so, you know, it's kind of not exactly what we think of as one person, one vote, but it's representatives from non-kin-based organizations. Like there's no clan representative, for example.
And examples of those cities, you will find them in Italy, northern Italy, you'll find them in Germany, That's what you're talking about.
Yeah. So Northern Italy, probably the first, and then Germany, they pop up in England and France.
Yeah. So, and that goes on to you said the Reformation, of course, that's religion, but other things that will happen during those centuries up until, let's say, modernity, that will be important, that will take us in this direction, because we know from history that people are asking this question, why didn't it become China, or what happened to the Muslim world? They were also highly educated or civilized areas in the world at the same time as Europe. But Europe.
Yeah. So one of the kind of links in the chain that I lay out in the book is that, you know, you have this marriage and family program in these nuclear families, and then you have these growing urbanization and charter towns. So think high Middle Ages. So, you know, 1000 to 1200. And you have this big increase in market integration. So you can actually, I show plots in the book of the increase in the number of these fairs. So this is like, you know, let's all come to town on Monday and we'll all trade our wares and we'll, you know, buy the stuff that we can't make and we'll sell our wheat or whatever we're growing. And you can still find this in parts of the world today. So I draw in from ethnography from around the world where I can show the psychological effects of markets. But there's reason to think that markets make people more pro-social towards strangers. So as these markets expand, people are becoming more willing to interact and cooperate with strangers, and they have small families, so they don't have this big set of clan loyalties and other people they can trade with. So there's kind of both a push and a pull for interacting and making deals and starting business enterprises with strangers. And this so growing market integration changes the nature of the West. It leads to economic prosperity for well-understood economic reasons, but then it also is changing people's psychology, leading them to be more open-minded and willing to cooperate with strangers in collaborative institutions. So it might have fed back into the politics, for example, political parties or other organizations that of strangers that need to get together for some interest group or something like that.
Yeah, that was a really interesting part in your book, I think, because it took psychology as the starting point. As many historians do, to have other starting points, but this was interesting. So, but then as we now come to today, this weird psychology developed slowly over the centuries and many centuries. Will then now new technologies, artificial intelligence, globalization, and so forth, make this process go faster? Because we are not at an end point. We are culture, psychology, and everything, as you just have explained to us, it's changeable. It changes all the time. So what do you think? Will this process go faster, and in which directions do you see it will go?
Yeah, so one of the ideas that I developed in a previous book, The Secret of Our Success, and that I put forth in this book is the notion of the collective brain. And that's the idea that innovation is really energized by bringing together large populations of interconnected minds. The idea being that most new inventions are actually recombinations of old, of other ideas that are already kind of existing there. And so I give lots of examples of industrial revolution level technologies that are like that. So like the steam engine. And so in the modern world with information technology, that should really help the collective brain. So we have, you know, the ability to sustain innovation. I mean, you can look at the creation of the vaccines as an example. So the world came together, ideas were swapped, genetic codes were flowing, and came up with vaccines relatively quickly. So that's on the plus side. On the minus side, I worry that a lot of the impersonal trust that made the economic system of the prior millennium function best is becoming less and less relevant as we begin to rely on information technologies as the way of securing transactions instead of, you know, trusting the baker or trusting the person that you're interacting with face to face. So I'm worried that may erode some of our trust. And you definitely see decline. I don't know if it's because of this, but overall you see declining trust in strangers, which is worrisome, at least if the requirements of the prior economic system are still relevant.
Yeah, because if we go into politics and if we're thinking about, I'm thinking about liberal democracies, human rights, those things that we are now have been discussing with others as well, is absolutely tied to this psychological development, even if we like it or not, and it's not universal as we might have thought it was some decades ago. So, and the big question there, if we take it over to your book, then will the world evolve towards this weird psychology, which means that it will evolve towards maybe an idea of liberal democracies, which is, of course, the unpersonal or neutral bureaucracy, this trust in strangers, all these things that we have been talking about, the institutions that are really important to make this work, and also human rights that is probably also really individualistic if we are putting it into your system here. So, and that's also a big question about China, because people are also always been asking, when will China become like us, will it ever be? And you might say now, I guess your answer will be, well, it depends on psychology here, because.
Yeah, and so that's a great example, because so what we've seen is China adopted a bunch of Western institutions. So they adopted some economic institutions, they copied the family and marriage patterns, but they instituted a one-child policy, which, for example, eliminated cousins. So that becomes a non-factor there. So in many ways, they weaken the family, but it's not like they just adopted all Western institutions. So they're an interesting recombination of, you know, old style Chinese political institutions, modern technology, and some Western institutions, right? So they're a new thing that hasn't existed in the world before. And so whether that's going to be, you know, the more powerful, more dominant economic system, and other countries are going to copy that system, or what's going to happen, I think is unknown, because we don't know what the performance of these different systems. I mean, certainly a top-down system like the Chinese is more fleet of foot in some ways and can take decisions faster than like the US government can take decisions. So that may make a big difference. And the idea that human rights is here to stay, I mean, we shouldn't be too confident of that. Even though, you know, most of us hold human rights dear and can't imagine how a world could ever let go of human rights. I think history tells us that populations will let go of human rights pretty quickly if they're not carefully guarded.
Yeah, I come to think about now a question that I've talked to Francis Fukuyama about also was his, he was in a period very interested in biotechnology. And since you are in that field a little, he was saying that when it comes to trial of different things that you might manipulate in biology, he said quite confidently that the Chinese would probably be much more willing to go much further on that than a Western would do. So how do you see that? Like, I mean, changing things in even designing babies or whatever he thought about.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that's interesting and I guess also scary about the world today is that, you know, lots of folks here at Harvard, for example, are worried about the bioethics of, you know, custom designing babies with CRISPR technology or something like that. But there's a lot of variation in that, and a lot of societies are going to be happy to plunge forward and, you know, just apply that technology. So China's the obvious case, but I think there's going to be other cases too. So these experiments are going to be done. It just depends where they're done and, you know, how we deal with them as they're being done.
Yeah, and he links it to China. He says they will probably be willing to go further, quicker than we will do. Is that something
that you share? I mean, I'm not a China expert, but my sense is they're not nearly as queasy about that as the folks across the river here.
And how tied do you think is this psychology to, we are talking about individuals and individualism and things, but this tied to liberalism? And what about socialism and communism that also are political ideologies in the West? So how do you explain that when it comes to this weird? Is this weird typically to liberalism?
Yeah, I think that a lot of what we think is our values around liberty and democracy and stuff, the argument I make is that the big institutions, so the formal institutions, national level institutions, are tied into this weird psychology. So if you have somewhere like China or even Japan, where the institutions are more of a combination, they include Western elements, but also non-Western elements, or so there's something new, then the psychology is going to be a bit different. So Japan is a great case because it has many, like the legal institutions are very similar to the US, but legally they operate quite differently. Americans love suing each other, but Japanese don't sue each other very often. So even though the mechanics are all the same, the psychology of the people is different. So it just functions differently. And so we should expect different psychologies to appear as these new recombinations of institutions appear, because the idea is these are interwoven.
Mm. So, and finally, do you think that psychology in general, when you are, this is back to psychology as such, when you we are experimenting and things, people or psychologists today are much more aware of this biased, as we started out with, Western psychology that is not at all the same all around the world. Do you see anything positive coming out of that and more research done on other people with other brains?
Yeah. Psychology as a discipline has been slow to respond. So my experience is that they quickly recognize the problem. And, you know, the numbers are huge in terms of the number of subjects that are mostly from America and then from Western societies and then a very small from anywhere else. But the discipline was not fleet of foot in figuring out how to address the problem. So there are some enterprises, but it's still not making a visible impact in the journals. And it's the textbooks are changing only very slowly. The discipline of economics has been much quicker in responding. And I think it's because there's a field of development economics and economic history is much richer and more quantitative. So the data coming out of economics and the amount of change we've seen in response to this issue has just been faster.
Great. So do you have anything to add? Do you think anything important that you wrote in the book that we have forgotten to talk about?
Well, I mean, I'll just mention a little bit about what I'm up to, kind of building off the project. And really what we're trying to do is we're trying to integrate history. So thinking about history, but also thinking about what are institutions, how do they evolve? And they evolve through human learning. So we need some psychology, think about how people learn things. And then how the institutions shape how we think. So we're trying to put all those elements together. So what my lab's doing now, we've got a team of historians and linguists and some Latin scholars. And we're looking at the corpora, the Latin corpora, and then also some English language corpora, and trying to track how psychology changes over time by developing techniques, kind of, you know, big data science techniques, natural language processing techniques for, you know, spotting individualism. You know, what is an individualistic? When is the author individualistic? Or how are individuals described in ways that are about their relationships or about their internal characteristics? And so, you know, at least we have some preliminary reasons to think this might not work. And this would be really powerful because then we can track change over time and across space, at least as we have texts available.
Oh, that's great. You will just have to notify me when that book comes, because I guess you will be writing another book then.
Well, yeah. We'll start with the paper, but I'll keep you in the loop.
Thank you so much, Joe, and thank you for joining me at the podcast today.
Okay, good to be with you.
Yeah, and the other thing for our listeners is that, of course, the book that he has written already, The Weirdest People in the World, it's available in Norway, and you can go to any bookstore or click on an internet page and get that book if you want to read. And if you like us and Liberal Halvtime, rate us and recommend us and give us feedback and use, for instance, my email, matilda@civita.no, or to my colleague, eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita you'll find at our homepage, www.civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne media.